Welcome to episode one of The Cinematologists, a film club and podcast for discerning cinephiles. My name's Dr. Neil Fox.
I'm Dr. Dario Linares.
And we are The Cinematologists. What is this podcast all about, Dario?
Well, I suppose it arises out of discussions that we had about our love of film and probably our increasingly developing love of podcasting as a medium for it, to be able to discuss the things that we're interested about cinema and about, you know, politics or any particular area that you might be interested in. And we wanted to do a podcast that encapsulated a live screening where we could discuss with audience members what they thought about a particular film. And we'd done our first screening on Monday night.
We did. We showed Alex Cox's Repo Man and in front of a nice group of people and had a good conversation about it. And that's going to be the crux of what we do.
Sure.
Is have the screening and with a sort of, you know, an intro from us or whoever the guest is that picks the film, if we go down that road later on, which we are interested in, and then after the film the kind of a live conversation, because we were also interested in, as much as we talk about film online, kind of having a space where the screening experience in the room with the film and with the audience was something that was kind of retained.
Sure, and it also gives people, doesn't it, listening out there, the chance to cue the film up themselves, listen to an introduction, hear about the film in some kind of context, watch the film, and then listen to the responses that the audience had in the room.
Yeah, and it was very much inspired by Greg Proops's Film Club, which is a very irreverent podcast and film club where he does the same thing. And it's just, we just thought it was a really nice format for allowing us to talk about movies that we love with people. But also, because of that kind of split, we get the chance in between the introduction and the kind of the post-film conversation to include other interviews with filmmakers or, you know, people who are coming down to the School of Film and Television, or people that we meet, filmmakers, critics, just cinephiles, wherever we go on our travels, to talk about the loose themes that we're going to have each week.
Sure. And we wanted this week, every week I think we're going to try and come up with a different theme. And because Neil has just come back from the Berlin Film Festival, luckily for him.
Yes, thank you.
We were talking about, we wanted to talk a little bit about independent film. And Neil has chosen the first film that we were going to screen, which we did screen on Monday, which was?
It was Repo Man, Alex Cox's 1984 cult indie classic. I just thought it was really, I mean, it's a film that I love and have always loved. And it was a very formative film for me in my taste and my, you know, my kind of sensibility. But also it kind of represents one of the high watermarks of independent filmmaking, that kind of early 80s American wave of punk and indie filmmakers. And I just thought it was a nice way to start. And it was great because most of the people in the audience hadn't seen the film. So
sure.
That was
it was an interesting sort of reaction, I think. And I was stunned, I think, would be a good description of some of the people's faces when the lights went up after that screen. But we'll talk about a little bit more about that later. We're also going to have a discussion about the Berlin Film Festival and what you did while you were there. And also there's an interview that you took. So who did you speak to?
I spoke to a filmmaker called Lucien Bousser, who's a filmmaker that I've known for years. He's a very independent filmmaker, musician, DJ, very prominent in East Berlin nowadays, but was kind of right on the ground when the wall came down and East met West, and was, you know, just kind of like the punks in the 70s in London, kind of just took the camera out to capture that moment, and made a series of films chronicling what life was like sort of in the early 90s as things were kind of changing. And he's just released a new film. So I wanted to talk to him about that and being an independent filmmaker in Berlin at times like the Berlinale, when it's very much an outward-looking city and all these people like myself descend to watch world cinema.
Brilliant. So we'll get into that later on the Cinematologist podcast. But first of all, here is our introduction to the live screening of Repo Man. Thank you very much for that warm, unsolicited applause there. Thank you for coming to the first Cinematologists podcast and screening. You might be asking why we're doing this. Well, we like to talk about films. We like to talk about the films we love, and we also really enjoy podcasting. We think it's a really important medium in terms of discussion, disseminating information. It's going to be increasingly important when it comes to academic and disciplinary areas, but we really enjoy talking about it and we enjoy listening to it as well. And we thought, we've got a lot to say about films, haven't we, in various different ways. So each week we're going to put this into a bigger podcast, which is going to have interviews and discussion between the two of us, and there'll be a central theme. What we're going to do is have a little bit of an intro of the film before we start, obviously, and then afterwards we'll watch the film and then give you guys a chance to comment on it or ask any questions. So anybody listening out there in cyberspace can queue it up, listen to the first half of the podcast, watch the film, and then come back and watch the second half. Hopefully you guys will be participants and you'll ask plenty of questions and it'll be more of a discussion. So Neil came up with the name cinematologist. So where does that come from, Neil?
Well, the cinematologist was the name given to the people who, when film scholarship was first kind of formalized in the 50s, that was the name given to people who kind of taught and were interested in film as a kind of scientific pursuit, as an artistic pursuit. And it seemed like an interesting name because it was supposed to bring together not just the people who were teaching film, but librarians, archivists, critics, anybody who had an interest in talking about film as an art form, as an industry, as this as this kind of, you know, emerging thing that was kind of, you know, taking on all these new forms around the world. And over time, it's become more about, you know, moving away from those, that kind of description of the people who do it, to actually the subject itself. So, and we felt, didn't we, that the cinema itself is kind of not central to the discussion as much as it used to be, obviously with the emergence of TV and obviously kind of, you know, people sort of talking about stuff on social media. So we thought it represented a good name for bringing people together of different backgrounds, different areas, to just engage in a conversation about cinema.
Yeah, and I think that the whole idea of the digital age has repositioned what cinema is. So in a sense, that name again links back to the idea of what is cinema in the 21st century, and when obviously it's the medium of the 20th century, I think. So we're going to keep putting these podcasts out 2 a month, so hopefully you'll get into the rhythm of coming along if you enjoy it. And then when we launch in September on iTunes with a full set of 8, and you know, we're hoping for a lot of interaction, maybe even some suggestions of films, although I think that we've got quite a few ideas lined up ourselves for that. And indeed, Neil chose tonight's screening, so you can blame him.
Yes.
Why did you choose tonight's film, Neil?
Why did I choose Alex Cox's Repo Man? Well, quite a few reasons. One, it's great, which is the main reason. But also because it represents many things which I love about cinema, and it's a very formative film for me. It was a film which kind of, you know, I saw when I was very young, and it introduced a way of thinking about film, not just, you know, in terms of what film could be and the way you could make films, which have stayed with me. And it introduced me to Alex Cox, it introduced me to a lot of kind of music from that era, but also this sensibility which was around in that kind of, you know, sort of at the end of the 70s and the early 80s, about just going out and making stuff and not being beholden to the idea that a film had to be a certain way, or it had to be made in a certain way, or sure, it had to follow certain tropes. You could just go out and you could kind of put anything you wanted up on the screen.
And it's a quintessential first feature, isn't it, really? But by somebody who's come straight out of film school, really.
Yeah, and it has all that. It's rough around the edges, but it has that unique energy, which is that first film energy of just, it's kind of insolent in a really good way. It's like it's full of energy, full of vigor, full of let's just get it all up on the screen and not care about what people think of it, really.
Yeah, and I think with the sort of audience we've got tonight, a lot of sort of young filmmakers in the audience, there's a sense in which it does kind of contest what you might sort of see as classical rules. It is a cult film in every sense of the word, really. But it's also a really archetypal lesson in how to put something together that does look like it's, you know, it's a proper feature film. It's not a student film in that way.
No, not at all. I think that's because Cox is very much a student of cinema. So he loves cinema, and he loves westerns, and he loves classic Hollywood, but he also, you know, loves punk, and he wants to make things in a certain way. So it felt ambitious to me when I saw it. It felt like it had things to say. I didn't know what it was saying. I was too young to really grasp a lot of the politics and a lot of the almost kind of philosophical positions that the film takes. But I knew that it felt important. It felt like this was a filmmaker.
How old were you in 84?
Oh, well, I didn't see it in 84. I would have been 7.
Right.
I think my life been very different from seeing this film at seven. But I think I saw it when I was about 16, when I really started getting into cinema. And I just saw it in a shop. And I liked the cover.
Sure.
And it looked cool. And it had Emilio Estevez in,
right,
who I liked from Young Guns.
Yeah. You see, I would have said Breakfast Club, but there you go.
Yeah, see, that I was. You're a bit older than me, so well, you probably had Breakfast Club before me. But yeah, and then seeing Emilio Estevez in a completely different light,
yeah,
was exciting. And he's never been in anything
remotely
like this since.
No, so, no, absolutely.
Which is a shame.
And Alex Cox, I mean, I know him primarily. I've seen a few of his films, maybe two or three. I haven't seen everything, and he is a sort of, you know, one of these outsider filmmakers. But I remember him primarily from Moviedrome,
yeah,
which was a kind of BBC Two. For those of you who don't know, it was a sort of BBC Two series where he came on and introduced cult films that he loved, and it was a really sort of staple, you know, weekly viewing practice for anybody who loved cinema. And you know, you get a sense of these films are really interesting and important, but not what you would see at mainstream theatres. That was really formative for me. So maybe, I don't know, where does Alex Cox sit for you?
He sits very highly for me, largely because of Moviedrome and what kind of doing that kind of showed me was that he's a filmmaker who he makes films, but he just loves movies. And
sure.
Moviedrome was him kind of talking about the movies that he loved and introducing people to, you know, a diverse array of cinema. He writes about cinema as well as kind of writing film. He teaches film. He's someone who, for me, embodies the kind of philosophy that if you like film, you can't really silo it into being a filmmaker. If you're
sure.
If you are a filmmaker, you should also be a student and a critic
and a teacher.
And a theorist and a teacher. You know, that it's all kind of, it's all wrapped up in the same thing. And I just always loved that—the fact that he would just turn up in all these different places that I was kind of interested in, where I would be like, oh, he's made a film which I really like. Oh no, now he's talking about this film, or now he's writing about, he's writing about Dennis Hopper or whatever it is.
Sure.
And it just kind of inspired me that you don't have to be pigeonholed.
Sure. But wasn't he a director really that the studio system couldn't kind of contain?
Oh no, he's very idiosyncratic. I mean, Repo Man's probably his most probably alongside Sid and Nancy, his most accessible film.
Mm.
And you might watch it tonight and think that's not accessible at all. But at the time, it was very straightforward compared to the
sure.
particularly the films we make later, like Walker, which is
bombed.
Famously bombed, but it's probably my favourite of his films. It's
right.
incredibly
with Ed Harris is again a very interesting role for Ed Harris, I think.
Yeah, I mean he's never done a film like that. But that film was full of kind of politics and this kind of really interesting use of anachronism and
sure.
the parallels between, kind of, you know, early American culture and the 80s, which obviously Alex Cox was most prolific when making films
and,
in the 80s.
And this film is very much a kind of a comment really on the 1980s as well, isn't it? And that shift that happened really in the 70s into the 80s, away from kind of classical mainstream Hollywood into the kind of new Hollywood period, let's say. And then you've got the two stars, you've got Emilio Estevez, and then you've got Harry Dean Stanton, of course, in this film. And he was a really interesting kind of choice, I think, wasn't he, for the lead, or one of the leads.
He's always an interesting... Anytime you put Harry Dean Stanton in a movie, you get something unique. I mean, I think there's very few people like him. But he does embody this kind of, this very old school idea of acting, of this kind of, you know, the outsider, the lone wolf kind of male figure in society, particularly kind of like post-60s
sure.
Society. And it's you can't make a film with Harry Dean Stanton in it and it not be kind of worth watching.
Sure. And he was notoriously tough, wasn't he, on set here?
I want to read an anecdote from Alex Cox's book called X Films, which is about his kind of recollections. And this is an anecdote about Harry Dean Stanton on set. So hopefully you know who Harry Dean Stanton is. In 1984, he was in Repo Man and Paris, Texas,
yeah.
which is a pretty good year. And two very, very different but kind of equally iconic performances. But famously, a very difficult performer. This is Cox talking about one of the many incidents he had. My inevitable Harry Dean showdown came when we shot the scene when the repo men threatened their sworn enemies, the Rodriguez brothers, with baseball bats. It was past midnight beneath a freeway overpass downtown. The prop man had thoughtfully provided fake and real baseball bats. Harry took a real one. The first camera rehearsal went very well, ending with Harry's swing at Del Zamora with his wooden bat. After we cut, Robbie called me over. Robbie Mueller was the cinematographer. We might talk about him in a sec. Just now, I felt the wind of a wooden baseball bat pass by my face, he said. I will not shoot this scene unless all the actors use plastic bats. The other actors were already using plastic bats. Only Harry wielded a wooden one. But when I asked Harry not to use the real bat, he was furious. Slamming his wooden bat down on the hood of the Falcon, he roared, and he has a stentorian voice for such a little guy, Harry Dean Stanton only uses real baseball bats. I didn't think to use the Robbie would like it if gambit because Harry then made the mistake of throwing his bat upon the ground. I picked it up immediately, realizing he'd almost lost his prop. Harry grabbed the other end. A foolish tug of war ensued to the great amusement of the crew. Harry and I were distracted by the deft Betsy and her valiant assistant, Rip Murray, into surrendering the disputed bat. All the wooden bats immediately vanished. The scene went wonderfully. I just love the idea of Harry Dean Stanton shouting in third person about what Harry Dean Stanton does.
And apparently there was another anecdote where he wouldn't learn his lines, apparently, and he was told, you know, you've got to learn your ads, it's part of your SAG contract. And he was just lost his temper completely with Alex Cox. And I think it was something to do with the age difference. You know, Cox was sort of 28, 29 at this point, and Harry Dean Stanton was in his 50s. So he loses his temper, and he says to Alex Cox, I've worked with the greatest directors of all time, Francis Ford Coppola, Monty Hellman. You know why they're great? Because they let me do whatever the fuck I want. And, you know, I think I'm going to live my life by that. You know why you're great, Neil? You let me do whatever I want.
And I do let you do whatever you want.
Exactly.
Which some people might think is a bad idea.
Absolutely.
But what's great, what I love about Harry Dean Stanton, and this is why I wanted to kind of mention this, is because that stuff is on the screen. That attitude is on the screen. You think about actors now. How many actors nowadays really, you know, kind of can put that energy on the screen? And we know that some actors are problematic. So Christian Bale, for example, is supposedly very difficult. And everyone's heard the scene where he shouts at the crew member on Terminator Salvation. You know, very famous, went viral. But when you watch Terminator Salvation, you don't feel that Bale... There's no anger in that performance, and there's no violence, and there's no intensity or even tension. Whereas when I watch Repo Man, and when I still watch it, there's... You don't really know what's going to happen. And you look at Harry Dean Stanton, and you think at any moment he could just go off and literally kill everyone around. And that makes it exciting because the film is set in this very violent, kind of very tense early 1980s Los Angeles where, you know, death was kind of, you know, an everyday occurrence. And these guys, you know, were real guys. Alex Cox went out and researched the movie with repo men who would go. And most of the dialogue comes from actual repo men. That tension is on the screen, and that tension has gone now. There's not many actors like Harry Dean Stanton, and certainly none who, when they're on screen, you feel there's a danger. You feel like, actually, I don't know what's going to happen with these guys.
Sure.
I feel that's kind of been lost to a certain extent.
And just to finish off then, do you want to say something maybe about what the music adds to the film? Because it's very important, I think, the soundtrack in this movie.
It captures the time perfectly, and it captures that energy of the time period. Well, like we were saying, where the world is slowly becoming this very kind of capitalist society, where, you know, aspiration and privilege is coming to the fore in a way that it hasn't before. But there's a lot of people who don't fit into that. Mm. And famously, Cox said that Emilio Estevez had the perfect blank but kind of ambitious canvas of a face.
Sure.
And I think that's great. And he is this person who doesn't really know what his life's going to be like. Mm. He doesn't, you know, and you can watch the film and think he certainly has no place in the America that Reagan is building or that the West is kind of building. And this music is so angry and so fierce that it perfectly captures that anger and that disillusion that they've got, but also the danger of... Mm. Of having to live hand to mouth in this kind of climate.
It's perfect kind of Generation X stuff.
It's brilliant, perfect generations. It's interesting about the music as well, because the music, I mean, the film wasn't seen very much. Universal didn't really know what to do with it, but they cleverly put together all the music on a soundtrack album, And obviously, it's the cream of like 1980s Los Angeles hardcore and punk music on an album. It's like a a compilation that people would die for. And the album did really well. And then people said, well, you know, where's this album come from? And they said, oh, it's the soundtrack to a movie. And they said, well, where's the movie? And they were like, well, it's no one's really seen it. So they got a re-release based on.
Sure.
So the music has served as a great way for people to experience the film and actually as a gateway.
So if you're listening out there in cyberspace, please cue it up and enjoy the majesty that is Repo Man. Okay, so you can hear the afterwards discussion a little bit later in the podcast. That was really well phrased. but right now we're going to discuss with Neil a little bit his trip to the Berlin Film Festival. So Berlin, I didn't get to go this year. How was it for you?
I was one of the lucky people who draw the long straw and managed to go for a few days, and it was great. I mean, I've been to a lot of film festivals, and it's always fun to go to the big ones and just kind of be kind of engulfed by cinema and to take the lottery of filmmakers that you know and films that you don't know.
I love that feeling of bombing around the city to the different venues. You know, auditoriums are fantastic there and the tube is great, so you can go, you end up all over the place, can't you?
Yeah, it's beautiful. You get to really see the city alongside the movies, although it can backfire. I mean, I got out of bed at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning to get to the other side of Berlin for a 9:30 screening.
That's dedication for you.
It is. You know, we are dedicated to cinema. Only to see the new Werner Herzog film, which was utterly terrible.
Oh dear.
And a real disappointment. And it's one of those things where I try not to read reviews in advance, but you kind of, as soon as I came out and read the reviews from the premiere the night before, realised, oh, I could have done with a lion.
Right. I don't know the name of that. It's called
Queen of the Desert, and it's the story of Gertrude Bell.
Okay.
And her kind of voyages across Arabia and kind of the formation of what we now understand geographically as the Middle East.
Sure.
Fascinating story. Nicole Kidman's very good in the role of Gertrude Bell, which is quite a thankless role. For what is an amazing woman, the story reduces her to this kind of uppity wanderer who does it because she's heartbroken, so it's right. It's obviously she's defined in this telling of the story by the men in her life, which just feels really reductive, and Herzog phones it in. There's no moments where you go, this is the man who made Aguirre, Wrath of God. This is completely absent. So but to be fair, that was the only negative screening that I saw, really. The rest were great. I caught an old Ruben Mamoulian Technicolor wonder called Blood and Sand with Tyrone Power.
Yeah, you were saying the print of that was fantastic.
Just beautiful, yeah. You know, as part of this kind of retrospective season, an absolutely glorious print from, I don't know when the print's from, but it was,
sure.
You know, the film's 1941 and it looked sensational.
And I'm very jealous also you got to see the new Guzman film, which, I'm a huge fan of Nostalgia for the Light. So
yeah, I mean, I sent you enough tweets and texts to rub that one in. And I was at the world premiere of that, which was just wonderful. I don't know how he does it, really. It's another remarkable piece of work which ties in just so many different kind of elements of sociology, cosmology, ethnography, politics, but just manages to tell this wonderfully philosophical and personal story. And it's beautiful and incredibly powerful and moving. That was a definite highlight, as was the new film by Alex Ross Perry, Queen of Earth, who, again, similar to Lucien, who I've known for years from the film festival that I used to run, someone that who I've become friends with through that festival. And it's amazing to kind of to see independent filmmakers still making work after film,
sure.
But also someone like him just really, really kind of growing as a filmmaker. And what I love about his work is that although it's very independent, micro budget, scraping together enough money and just going out and shooting it with small crews, it's always cinematic. He's shooting on film. He's interested in the language of cinema. It's not just, well, we've got a micro budget, let's just stick a camera room, And his new film is a beautifully kind of tense 1960s psycho thriller with shades of Bergman and Cassavetes and particularly Polanski, and he was there talking about that influence.
That links a little bit, doesn't it, to Repo Man, because with that film, you've got this first feature. It's almost a kind of student film, but then the cinematographer, Robbie Mueller, is one of the greats of all time. So this great cinematographer comes in and makes this first feature look absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it just having that cinematic sensibility just elevates it, and it just somehow Mueller captures the energy of that film beautifully, but also makes it look absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you sort of tapped me on the shoulder in the screen, and particularly in that great kind of two shot with Cy Richardson in the front and Parody's
right.
in they're both in their cars. It's just a painting, and you wish that nowadays that's how people approached independent filmmaking, with that level of artistry.
With that in mind, then, do you want to just again set up the interview that you
you
have over there?
The interview is with a filmmaker called Lucien Bussa, who I wanted to talk to about his new film Berlinized, which is a document of life in post wall coming down Berlin and kind of the party scene and the art scene, where it was just, you know, as he sort of alludes to, just a crazy time, you know, just in free. But then how that's changed, because obviously I've been going to Berlin quite a lot, and it was very different to see this time, and he talks about that. So hopefully you'll get a sense of the city of Berlin, you know, outside of the film festival.
Great. So we'll play that now.
I'm in Berlin for the Berlinale, and I've taken time out to catch up with a very old friend of mine, Lucien, who lives here in Berlin, and he's agreed to talk to me about the city and about his life as a filmmaker for our Cinematologist podcast. So, Lucien, hello.
Hello.
Tell us about your film Berlinized.
Yeah, Berlinized is a documentary, and it captures the time in Berlin Mitte after the wall fell down. After the wall fell down, the city was suddenly double-sized because there was no wall anymore. And we all discovered the other part of the city. And because there was this historical moment, there was a lot of houses, not sure who is the owner of the house, and there was some people, some Jews, for example, who are now in Argentina or somewhere, or in Israel, and they owned houses, and you have to find them first, and then you could sell it to somebody else or give it back to them. So there was a lot of property which was unclear who was the owner, and that's why it was empty, for example. And we went in and made a bar or a club or a gallery, or we put some bar in the stairways and sold the beer out of the can and had a ghetto blaster to have the music and stuff like this. So it was really really free time, and there was other films, a lot of other films only catches the techno scene in the 90s, which was also really influential, and a lot of films capture the East Germans who discover her new role in Germany. But this scene was not captured so far, and that was my scene, and I was really active at the time at this I had a video show called Alien TV, and it was basically, I got the inspiration from a friend of mine who was mixing in the club the TV news and films into his music, which he was DJing. Okay. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. I really have to do it with my own filmed material.
Yeah.
Because Berlin was, especially in the East, there was this clubs and bars and crazy people, but the rest was a big construction site. And this is optical, really amazing.
Yeah.
And I was filming and filming and filming. All these big drillers which goes to the river to make a stand for the bridge or stuff. And this was optically amazing. And I mixed the driller, for example, with the sound into my DJ sets. Or there was like sometimes 10 musicians who was jamming to it. And you always had this video sound also was really important for me.
Great, that sounds fantastic. So the film is a lot of the stuff that you shot at the time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Only
the stuff that you shot at the time. Wow.
And then I thought, when I looked at the material, when I looked at my archive, because I saved all the tape, and because I always had my camera with me, I was also having the camera in the club and filmed some concerts, performances, crazy stuff. I experienced. So I really could do a documentary out of it, because I have the old footage from the construction sites and the people. And then I went back to these old friends and trying to find out what, how the freedom we had, and the crazy freedom affects their creative life.
Yeah.
Today. And it turns out that they was really straightforward. They just did stuff, and they still do stuff. Not think about if they are able to do it.
Yeah.
Or if they are allowed, or if they have the possibility, they do it. And that is a total different self-confidence than today, where you have to find a gallery which wants to exhibit your work, or you have to find a label and stuff like this, or you have to get concession for your club,
and
stuff. That was really amazing.
Yeah. So there's still a community of people that kind of make stuff in that way that you found by sort of going back to make the film.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah. Just one more thing, and
sure.
It was the spirit of the time which I wanted to. The message of the film, the second message, the meta message, is the fact that if you have a moment of senseless creativity, your most strongest creative moment you can have. And it's like a child who is painting a picture, and sure, it wants to impress somebody, maybe, but that's okay, but it doesn't think about, oh, how much money can I get for this? Or I will be a big artist, because the category is not the way children think.
Yeah, it's just harnessing that emotion in a moment, like you said.
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic.
And that was a very strong moment at the time.
Yeah.
And this is what everybody has as a way of being creative today also. Correct.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So it's interesting that what you were saying about how much changed, you know, in Berlin in that time, but also that there are elements that haven't changed. And I was saying to you before, where we are now in Prenzlauer Berg, the last time I came here, it felt like you were talking there. It was very much a kind of community of artists. Everything was kind of improvised places. You took us to some places that were just literally people at a bar. But now coming back, it seems very different. So I just wondered if you could talk about how your neighborhood has changed, I suppose, in Berlin in the last, in the last sort of 10 years or so.
Yeah, the death moment, the killing moment of this kind of way of life and this scene was the football European World Cup in 2006.
Yeah.
I think, or a little bit earlier. And people, there was one club down the road here, and he started to put a screen into his club, and people came there and watching football, and at the time other people was recognizing, oh no, that's a great way to get people into my club, and suddenly everybody was watching football in the club, and a DJ or creative people was not as important anymore as this football game. After the football was over, it's like 90 minutes, it's a really long time, then the DJ starts and the visuals, but if you have to DJ after a football game, you need at least an hour of hard crass music, for example, to get the people's attention, to get the vibe back.
Yeah.
If you ever manage to get the vibe back.
Yeah.
Because the people are paralyzed, like they're watching a football game, and I don't have I don't care about if people are watching football, that's okay. But it's just a fact that it killed this vibe. And suddenly people was waving flags, German flags in the street, and cool people from the scene like wearing this flags on their
cheek
and stuff like this, and it was suddenly the focus changed so much. And from that time the possibility to make money out of something was kind of more important than to have a good vibe in the evening.
Great.
And it also happens to Prenzlauer Berg. The house owners, I guess in 2001 or 2002, every house was, they found every house was clear who's the owner. No. The ownership of the houses was cleared in 2001 or 2002 or 2003.
Yeah.
So they could start to renovate all the houses and to make it pretty and to sell it again and to get rid of the old tenants, to hire the rents even more. And now Prenzlauer Berg is like a nice living room, kind of. It happens like in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
In Williamsburg, in New York, same thing. It happens everywhere, but it was because of this special historical moment in Berlin with the wall, the divided city. It was a really special historical moment. Because of that, it was something different like in Williamsburg, because this was just a district where nobody, it was not hip, that was all.
Yeah.
But here it was transforming, was like a historical transformation of the city to something we don't know where it will be in 10 years maybe.
Yeah. One more question for you. Obviously I'm here for the Berlinale, and you're a filmmaker who lives in Berlin. I just wondered if you could talk about your kind of experience and thoughts on, you know, what is one of the biggest film festivals in the world, and, you know, and your kind of relationship to it as a very, you know, idiosyncratic filmmaker in the city that it's hosted in.
It's a really, really wonderful festival, I have to say. And I really love to go there, not every year, but I went there for years. I was in the Berlinale fever all day long, and I try to catch wonderful films. I'm not so much into watching everything. I pick my films, and then I have some shitty ones in between, but I pick the right ones most of the time, and in the end I have three films which I really that's the three films of the year, this year's Berlinale.
Yeah.
And as a filmmaker, yeah, it's like I'm not really they are not really supportive to some risky projects. They are really big, and it's like making films like I do. I finance it all by my own. I don't have any TV stations involved. No money from a founding. How you call it?
Funding partners.
No money from funding partners. So if you do it like this, then it's really hard to get a connection to them, because they don't have to show you.
Yeah.
If you have founding money or TV station, the TV people come to Berlinale people and say, hey, this is our money's inside, can you show it? And that's why it is really hard to get supported by them. But And sure, if it doesn't fit in the theme or they have another Berlin film already, that's another thing. I'm not kind of blame somebody, but it's okay like it is, because this film was growing over like 15 years now, and it will find his way anyway, because it's a really strong historical statement. And
and you said that you'd had some good, you have like a cinema screening that sells out regularly. And
yeah, I showed in a little cinema since 2 years in Prenzlauer Berg, and it's always sold out once a month. And it's really amazing. Tourists coming to see the film, old Berlin people, friends of mine, or people who lived at the time in Berlin who also experienced the time, or new Berliners from all over the world see this film and get an idea how it really was. And that is a really strong statement, this movie. So time is on my side anyway.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Lucien. Let's go and have some pizza.
Let's have some pizza in the best pizza place in Prenzlauer Berg.
So some really fascinating stuff there. I mean, what struck me about that is when I was over in Berlin, you know, the sort of eastern side was really amazingly sort of well preserved in terms of the architecture. But it seems from the interview there, he was saying that there's a huge gentrification, a huge change that has gone since the Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was amazing having, I mean, the last time I was there about 6 years ago, and he still lives in the same place, but around him, everything has changed. It's completely unrecognizable. Even when I was there, there was no bars, no coffee culture. It was very much indie, you know, people just doing pop-up bars, pop-up venues, you know. And there was this wonderful old Eastern Bloc apartment block, which was just being overrun by artists. And sure, there was musicians and bands and filmmakers and photographers in every room, and there was dark rooms, and you would just go on every floor, and it was just this hive of activity, and people were just kind of creating. And now that is, you know, a very expensive apartment building.
Yeah, it's become very commercialised.
Yeah, and he was sort of saying how, you know, all those people that, you know, I'd met before are having to move out. You know, it's the same story as New York, it's sure, the same story as London. And it's interesting, obviously, that, you know, that that he was saying as well, that Berlin doesn't really, as a festival, doesn't really touch on its own location in terms of how it's, you know, its own.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Is that, I mean, we have these discussions about what film festivals should do, particularly in certain areas. I mean, it may be different for Berlin in terms of what the Berlin Film Festival is trying to do commercially, and, you know, sell its products and that kind of thing. But even, you know, any film festival that's in a specific area, how much does it have to cater for that area, represent that area, is an interesting question.
Yeah, and I think we, you know, I was just sort of saying to Lucien, it would seem to make kind of commercial sense,
yeah,
you know, because you've got all these people coming from all over the world, filmmakers and audience members, to see films and to experience the city. You know, you'd think it would make kind of commercial sense to have a representation of the city on film in a contemporary way.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was nice, you know, to hear him talk about the screenings that he has locally where people come out and support. And again, like everything really, you get a sense that there is this kind of ongoing film culture which just makes stuff and shows stuff.
Sure.
And thankfully, although it's very, very hard now to find independent film or any kind of alternative cinema on the big screen, there are still pockets, and
yeah,
it is still possible with a lot of graft, and that's kind of encouraging.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that, because there is this sort of school of thought that suggests there's either your $250 million blockbuster or there's zero budget whatsoever. And the notion of a kind of mainstream independent cinema is kind of under threat or disappearing. I mean, did you feel that, or do you think that the Berlinale, you saw examples of that kind of cinema?
Well, I think the programme is so big that there's always a space for that. I think the problem is something like the Berlinale doesn't really know what kind of festival it's supposed to be. It is a big marketplace, mm-hmm, so it is valuable in industrial terms, but there's never a clear sense of what the festival is about. You know, I mean, even going there, you you get that it's about cinema, but what really is it, you know? And there is a sense that they are just kind of scrabbling around and getting the premieres that they can get hold of without any...
It seems very commercial, you know, there's those stories about Harvey Weinstein flying in and then buying what he needs to buy and then jetting back out again.
And you've got the 50 Shades of Grey world premiere, and you think, you know, is
really?
That, you know, it's nice, you know, it's a great screen, and, you know, but is that the kind of film... Does that film need the exposure? That's where I always come from in terms of a festival is, do we need to see those films in that way? You know, could we not be a bit bolder in terms of elevating other filmmakers and other films to that level where they get that kind of, and then you kind of think that's the role of festivals a lot of the time, because what they put up and what gets liked by the critics or, you know, the bloggers, then can it hopefully influence what gets seen on screens? Whereas if they're just showing 50 Shades of Grey, it kind of just permeates this constant, oh, well, that's what people want to see. Those other films, like the Guzman film and Alex Ross Perry's film, you know, the chances of those films ever getting a cinema release becomes much harder, which
and
is
we get a kind of aspect of that living down here in Cornwall, don't we, with the distribution that we get down here, which ain't great.
It's not great, but I almost feel like an archaeologist when I kind of go online and find a cinema. Oh, there's this, you know, over in Newquay, they're showing Foxcatcher in Newquay, or they're showing Selma, and we kind of do the road trip, which is kind of... It's kind of fun when you're out there doing it, but on a regular basis, it is disheartening that, you know, you read about these films that, you know, have, just look amazing, these filmmakers that you love, and then you kind of, your heart sags when you go, I haven't seen Inherent Vice on the big screen
because it's
not down here, and that's really sad.
I think that might be a theme of the podcast to come.
We'll hopefully keep it.
What we haven't seen.
We'll hopefully keep it this side of negative.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so now we're going to play the second half of our Q&A, the Q&A bit of our screening of Repo Man.
Wow. Well, I don't know what to say, because it's sort of 20 years since I've seen that. It's long. I mean, I was really shocked and amazed how well shot it was, and the lighting, cinematography was just fantastic. And you said it was sort of rough and ready around the edges, and it definitely, you know, definitely was in lots of ways. But some of the lighting, I mean, is that scene in the car, two cars adjacent to each other, and then the some really complex stuff in and out of the space as well, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, when I sort of said rough and ready, it was definitely the feel of the whole film and the way, I mean, like the narrative and just, you know, just there's a kind of energy to it which is a bit rough. But it was shot by Robbie Mueller, who, you know, I mean, in the space of 3 years, he shot that and Paris, Texas in the same year. Then he shot To Live and Die in L.A. for Friedkin. And then he shot Down by Law for Jarmusch. And he shot a lot of Wender stuff. He shot a lot of Von Trier stuff, 24 Hour Pie People. I mean, you know, he's just one of the great cinematographers. And what's amazing is that all that independent cinema in the 80s, it's kind of different to what it is now. It's they believed in cinematic artistry and some of those compositions, and like you say, some of the lighting and some of the camera work is just beautiful.
It kind of reminded me a lot watching it there, and the first time I sort of picked up on that because I watched this other film recently, They Live, John Carpenter's film. It's very similar to that in many ways, and especially the stuff where he goes into the family and, you know, he's eating the out of the can with food on it. You know, and they're watching the TV evangelist on the TV, and it is that whole sort of sense of the post-war generation have just sort of given out, and they've spawned this X generation who are just kind of like, you know, trying to get any kind of job that's going in an economy that isn't kind of working. This kind of theme, I think.
Yeah, and the visual, I mean, it looks kind of both budgetary, so they have to kind of do product placement or pay for any branding, but it also has this really interesting aesthetic throughout the film with this really kind of bland corporate sort of, you know, non-identity of everything is just really bland and uniform, and it kind of gives that whole kind of zombie-like feel to everything.
And nothing that the there's lots of scenes that don't seem to kind of play out. It just clips along, doesn't it, where it's like, for example, they go to the bar and he's surrounded by the women and that, and you're kind of like, That would get cut out ordinarily, and they just showed a little bit of it, and then he's on to walking down the street, and, you know, that happens a lot, I think.
Yeah, scenes just sort of end.
Yeah.
Like he sort of says, I was, you know, when, he just leaves Harry Dean Stanton like seven or eight times, and then, oh yeah, I'm sorry, later on, and lots of kind of really fortuitous things happen plot-wise, because I don't think it's necessarily interested in, I mean, there's no arcs. There's no three-act structure to it.
No.
It's just...
And the last 20 minutes really, you know, just goes off the deep end, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, in brilliant, you know, just like... what we were sort of talking about earlier about, you know, actions and explosions, like what can we do? Are we going to have a helicopter?
Yeah,
we'll have everybody, we'll have, you know,
everybody in the hospital,
the force field on the car, everything's just, it just goes crazy.
Yeah. So, what did you guys think? Anybody want to ask a question or make a comment?
How do you have the thought process to make something like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the stuff he wrote ad hoc on you know, as shooting was taking place, I think they had the basis of the script, but then a lot of the monologues were written in casting. I mean, there's the sort of guy who's completely off his head in the yard, the one who doesn't drive, you know, I get the bus because, you know, driving makes you stupid and that kind of stuff. And then obviously he sort of takes off at the end, but then he's got that long monologue, you know, and that kind of stayed in as it went along. But again, I think it's just a case of trying to find what you can do, you know, with a very small budget, I think, in terms of the script.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he was interested in that world of Repo Men, you know, and he was based in LA at the time, and he knew all these, you know, musicians and kind of was getting to know actors and just wanted to, he just thought it was cool. You know, in the same way that people think it's cool to make movies, that's his idea of let's go out and make a cool movie.
And the narrative fits into the use of cars, you know what I mean? It's driving around in LA, and there's definitely sort of, you know, there's the whole sort of taxi driver stuff going on with the tracking shots along the street and this kind of stuff, and the rubbish going everywhere. And then you've got that scene where he's walking down the street, and there's the guy in the, you know, radiation suit coming to pick somebody up, you know, which is really nicely put together, but really funny.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of sketches and a lot of little ideas for kind of visual gags, little satirical kind of making satirical points as it goes, and just throwing them in wherever, regardless of the fact of whether it's going to make sense or whether it links to anything. It's just like, oh, this will be funny, or this will make a point about, you know, how people treat the homeless and how you know. So let's just do it.
What do you think about all the sort of radiation stuff going on? Yeah, it's aliens, but did you sort of pick up what that might be kind of referring to, and the people, you know, in the white suits and clearing people off the streets and
kind
stuff.
Kind of fun take on a B-movie style, kind of like Masters, was it the invaders from outer space and kind of stuff.
Right. But there is definitely a sort of B-movies 50s thing, but also relates to kind of 80s and the nuclear war, nuclear arms race, I think,
yeah,
as well.
I think Luke was right. It definitely taps into a kind of Cold War paranoia that was very much part of the B-movie movement in the 50s and 60s. It's definitely tapping into that same thing of, you know, using aliens as a metaphor for,
absolutely,
nuclear annihilation.
Absolutely. And is anybody, what did everybody make of Harry Dean Stanton? Have you ever seen him anything before?
Yeah. Have you seen you've always seen The Avengers.
Escape from New York. You know that film?
Yeah.
Harry Dean Stanton.
He's the taxi driver guy. Paris, Texas, nobody seen that?
Not yet. He's in The Green Mile as well, isn't he?
He's in The Green Mile?
He is in The Green Mile a bit. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's interesting just to know how you guys know Harry Dean Stanton, because obviously for us, he's very much a, the Paris, Texas and...
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
And this movie.
Well, what about Emilio Estevez? You all know him, no? Yeah.
Breakfast Club.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's Charlie Sheen's brother, obviously, and then son of Martin Sheen. But he changed his name to reflect his mother's side, I think.
Yeah, isn't his name... His name's like Michael Douglas or something like that.
And oh, really?
That's like...
Isn't that Michael Keaton who's Michael Douglas?
Or someone like that. But his name is already taken, so...
Right.
He took the Spanish name. Because I think they've all got Spanish names.
No, I think definitely Michael Keaton was Michael Douglas before he changed it to Michael.
He's definitely got... He definitely couldn't be whatever his name was, so he took the Spanish name from his family.
Sure.
Which they've all got, yeah.
Anyone else want to? We can all go to the pub if you like, but...
Yeah, just like thinking about it, because I think you could say that Repo Man is kind of like, it's very much a film of its time. Like, it's definitely an 80s film. You could never make it in another era. But do you ever think it's possible that someone could make a film that is similar to Repo Man, but it would be prominent to like its like time? So like, do you think it's possible that someone could ever be able to make a film like Repo Man, but in a way that it would fit into, like, say, the 2010s or such?
Well, if you look at a film like The Matrix, for example, yeah, I think that's dated. Completely. No, computers don't look like that anymore. You know, we've got Windows and Macs and all that. The interface isn't that green and black screen with green lettering, and the phones are not used in the same way. So it's exactly. So it's completely dated because of its technology, and you know, it's the same here. Technology tends to date films. I mean, you look at there was actually a disc camera in that film. Anybody ever heard of a disc
camera before?
Is it that one they were messing around
with? Yeah, that's right. It used to be a really flat thing, and you put in, it looked like it was like a plastic CD that went in. It had little bits of film perforated all the way around, and you put the thing in and you clicked it, and it winded round. Yeah, it was kind of, you didn't get the photo straight away, but you went then and went, put the disc in, and the disc got developed, you know, and it was just a sort of compact way instead of using film. And then,
how much we've forgotten over time.
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And then, the special effects at the end definitely looked like they came from the ZX Spectrum.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyone else want to make
just to carry on, I think people, the film has something to say, you know, and I think that a lot of those films that came out around that time, they were interested, you know, they were connected to the culture that they were part of. I don't know how much those kind of films are. There's that many filmmakers now who are making films that are interested in saying things like that. There's no filmmakers interested in politics, you know, that are making independent film, really, that gets any kind of release like Repo Man would have got. I would love to see people kind of taking that, let's just do it approach, let's, you know, let's have that attitude. But I think what's important as well is that Alex Cox, Jim Jarmusch, and Dick Rude, who's in that movie, then went on to write Straight to Hell with Alex Cox. They all came out of punk, and they all came out of a kind of a disillusionment, which led to them wanting to do stuff. And now there isn't that kind of feeling. You know, people want to make movies more because it's cool to make movies and, you know, to be part of filmmaking or whatever. There's not so much, let's do all that cool stuff and have fun and kind of be famous, but let's also, there's a point to it. You know, we are angry and we do want to kind of, and I love that scene at the end where he's, you know, Dick Rude's dying and he's saying, you know, society made me this way. So that's bullshit. Yeah, you know, there's so many of those little moments where there is a direct kind of commentary on America and kind of capitalism and this kind of growing horror of Reagan. And that's what I think is missing. I think you can make a film which apes all the B movies and, you know, has a lot of car chases in a bit.
But that would be today, and it would be packaged very unironically, or, you know, kind of meta-ironically, as this is what it's aping off. This is the stuff it's referencing to. Whereas that is really has something to say underneath, even though the chaos is, you know, just everywhere. I think, Michael.
Yeah, this kind of follows on from what you've just said, but it really did feel like he'd taken the idea of the Repo Man, what this job is, and sort of broadened it out to something much bigger. This sort of, this slightly strange job that's like they're not criminals, they're within the law, but they act like criminals, and they kind of, he seemed to be sort of maybe expanding that a bit to comment on the church and the state and all kinds of different things. And just the whole idea of repossession in general, of that you haven't, you know, you're not paying your bills, therefore the thing you own will be repossessed. I don't think I've quite
it's very
processed
cynical
in my head how much far he took that idea, but it feels like he really took it very far.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sort of cynicism there that everybody is, you know, there are no jobs, there was an entire history of post-World War II America where this older generation had a job for life, and then suddenly we're in this economy where there are no jobs around, and anything will work for a fast buck, and it's all about the individual. And I think that, you know, he is sort of playing around with those kinds of things, I think.
Yeah, and I think as well, and the object, you know, it's very much a film about the thing and the thing that people aspire to have. And you notice that most of the cars he repossesses are good-looking, attractive cars. They're not junk. You know, so all these people who are supposedly poor and can't keep up repayments, they're still aspiring to have nice things. I think, which is very, very interesting. Yeah. Everyone's, you don't know who the bad guys are. You know, are they bad? Are they good? And he goes to that, the old woman's house, who's clearly playing him, and she's, sure, you know, and it's, he doesn't, there's no sides. Everyone is repossessing.
Yeah,
you know, things all the time.
And nobody has a proper conversation, do they, throughout? It's just all arguments. It's all kind of antagonism. It's all everybody shouting at everyone else.
Yeah, and you know, and Harry Dean Stanton, brilliant as he is purely has this code.
Yeah.
And it's mantra, and it's kind of, you know, it's all sound bites.
Yeah.
There's no real people in that film.
Repo Men Take Speed.
They do, yeah, and let's just take some speed.
Yeah.
And let's go get a drink, and it's intense.
Excellent. So, any last questions, or should we go and avail ourselves of the bar or something like that? Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. Much appreciated.
Yeah, just before we go, just wanted to say a big thank you to Philly Blumel, who did our logo. She's not here, but she's done a wonderful logo for us. So I wanted to thank her. And we also wanted to thank our producers here, Marcus, Mike, and James. So if we could have a round of applause for them. And then we'll say
good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Next week is Band Apart, so we hope we see you for that as well.
So that was our first screening. How do you think it went?
I think it went really well. Very pleased for a first. For
pleased
a first
with the turnout.
Yeah, nice turnout. You know, some good input from people. I think, you know, there was a lot of sea of faces, people who weren't quite sure of what they'd seen.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that not only... Yeah, a lot of people hadn't seen it, but also they're probably not aware of that kind of film or that era of filmmaking. So
yeah, there was a lot of our students, and I was really interested in how it played to them. But I suppose as well that with us two sat in front saying this was great, it's difficult, isn't it, to sort of criticize. But hopefully we'll get more, you know, criticism of the films in a sort of broader sense.
I think that's what we want, isn't it? Really, we want that conversation. It's not a look at our taste, isn't it great kind of thing. It is a conversation to see how people respond to different films that mean a lot to us and to other people. And I think that, yeah, that was, we know there are things that we would do differently next week and change. But I think that, as we've sort of said before about podcasts, you know, that there is that kind of finding your feet stage, and we are in that stage. But
yeah.
I think overall, and the response on Twitter was really good.
That's right.
And even this morning coming into work, you know, people, there seemed to be a little bit of a buzz from the people there that they'd enjoyed it and thought it was a good thing. So
yeah, hopefully they'll come back next week.
Hopefully.
For Band Apart.
Yes, Band Apart. And you've picked that.
Yeah, I have. I mean, we had long discussions about what we were going to screen, didn't we? And I think we picked this as, I suggested this as a counterweight, really, to Repo Man. It, you know, it is a sort of, really sits in a kind of classical understanding, I think, today. And, you know, Jean-Luc Godard is a Marmite filmmaker. I happen to love him. I do understand why people hate him. I think that, you know, that as you were saying, his style and what he is to cinema is mined an awful lot, particularly by, you know, American independence of a contemporary scene. So Band Apart, I think, is his most accessible film. And, you know, there's a couple of classic scenes in there. Anna Karenina, fantastic, you know, so there's a lot of stuff to look forward to, and I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it in a while. So I'm interested to see, yeah, how it plays for our, you know, for our students and for people who, you know, ordinary kind of film audiences. Hopefully there'll be a few of them there who will be used to seeing the things that have homaged it or stolen from it directly, and seeing how they, you know, how they respond to the original source.
Postmodernism, mate.
It is postmodernism. That's what we say.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious to see how it plays out and to see if it's how it feels as the original source of many ideas and
So that's next week. That's it for today's edition of the Cinematologist podcast. I'll have to learn how to say that clearly.
Yeah. We might have to find a little short word doing it.
Please come and visit us on our Facebook page. We are also on Twitter at Cinematologists, and our website is www.cinematologists.com. I got it all out.
That was good.
So we've got a few people to thank, Neil.
Yeah, we've got Philly Blumel, who did the logo and the poster for and the kind of the branding for the website. And everywhere you sort of see, you will see the Cinematologists online. It's her work. I think she's really captured a feel that we love.
I love the artwork.
Yeah, it's great, and very happy, and it kind of, I think it captures the tone of what we're trying to do. And then there's our producers, the great students that we're working with on this, Michael, Marcus, and James, and they were great yesterday at the screening, very professional. So looking forward to working with them, and very grateful to have them on board.
So that's it for episode 1 of the Cinematologists. We hope you can join us next time.